people sometimes don't realize like what you have to do to actually get that animal on the ground and also do it safely. Because if you do it and you're unlucky, even you can't prevent everything. But if the animal falls down on its wrong side, or with his trunk or a stick on its head or something, then you even lose the animal. So
yeah,
I was really impressed by this. And also humble, and also it motivated me and my team even more,
right,
to make sure that whatever we put on that animal is doing as much as we can.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast, where we explore the emerging technologies for building greener, healthier, and smarter communities. I'm your host, Dr. Nadine Khalla, and this week, I'm thrilled to introduce you to Tim van Dam, co-founder and director of Smart Parks. This was a fascinating conversation. It kind of veered off of the content that we typically cover on the show. Tim's organization, Smart Parks, develops and deploys emerging technologies to protect wildlife, from rhinos in Tanzania, to elephants in India, to bison in Europe, to cats in New York City. Yes, that last one is a real project of theirs. Tim spoke super eloquently on the Internet of Things and why it's changed the game of wildlife protection. It was fascinating to learn about his own beginnings, his first interaction with wildlife, and how he pivoted from a pretty cushy career in telecommunications to wanting to apply those skills to wildlife protection. He quite modestly shared that there hasn't been a single rhino killed in every single park that Smart Parks has worked on. He shared his recent experience collaring an elephant with an elephant tracking collar that he made himself, and how he stays motivated in the face of illegal wildlife poaching. It's truly inspiring, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Tim. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to have you because Smart Parks has been something that's been on my radar for quite a while now. You guys are using all kinds of exciting emerging technologies, specifically in the Internet of Things space, to preserve and conserve wildlife. Can you tell us a little bit more about what Smart Parks is?
Yeah, sure. In one sentence, we say that Smart Parks is an organization that protects wildlife with passion and technology. So that sounds really broad, but in a way, it's already really focused because, yeah, we have everybody who's working with us and at Smart Parks has a huge passion for wildlife and for technology. And technology for us is a tool we use to fulfill our mission, to protect the wildlife we love. So that is what we do. And technology is something, of course, we can talk about, but that we see as a tool and we use quite some modern technology to do what we want.
Right. But it's about using technology as a tool and not necessarily the end game in itself.
No, it really starts with the mission of protecting wildlife. So we all see that the wildlife around us is being attacked and needs help from being saved from humans. and we think that technology is one of the tools that we can use to do that.
Mm. And how did this start for you? When was your first encounter with wildlife?
Well, my first encounter with wildlife in Africa, that is where the idea in the end started, I guess, was when I was a 14-year-old boy. So I just turned 38, so that's a long time ago. But I was visiting Tanzania with my parents and my sister and my brother, and we went on a real safari, so with a 4x4 vehicle going into the famous Serengeti. And there we were all amazed by the beauty of real wildlife, as maybe some people, well, we did only knew it from movies, watching The Lion King, literally. And that was even like an animation, of course, but that was really impressive for all of us. And somehow everybody in our family got to do something with Africa and with the wildlife. And for me, that came years and years later when I was more in a professional work environment, I got the chance to do something with the knowledge I gathered from about technology. So my first experience was really like a long time ago. But later I realized and learned that this same wildlife was under attack. And yeah, I had the chance to come up with ideas to help counter that. So that's
So your whole family is doing different things in Africa now, based on that one experience?
Yeah, so maybe a strange story, but my father was also concerned with the wildlife and especially the rhinos. So he started helping Tony Fitzjohn, who is one of the key conservation people in rhino conservation, who was leading a rhino sanctuary to protect eastern black rhinos in Tanzania, trying to breed them back into a healthy population. And he started to help him to do that, supporting him financially, but also with the Suzuki Rhino Foundation from the Netherlands. My sister ended up doing a study, and she spent quite some time with Maasai in the Masai Mara and in Serengeti. My brother started to design luxury lodges in Zanzibar. My mother started to design a house, which she wanted to do in Tanzania. And later I started to do technology for conservation. So in that end, we all ended up with doing something for Tanzania, for wildlife and conservation.
And now one of the co-founders of Smart Parks.
Yeah, indeed. So when I got, one of my first jobs was working for a telecom operator in the Netherlands called KPN. And I got the question from the board to explore for this telecom operator to see, okay, what are the scenarios to be played out in the future on two sides. So one, where is society going? And second, what kind of technologies will emerge? And can you bring those two together into a vision, essentially, into scenarios? And I was doing that together with a small group, especially with a Professor Nico Bakken. We interviewed a lot of people. We wrote a lot. We selected a lot of books, a lot of movies, so a lot of documentation. And essentially, in the end, we said, like, how can we bring all these ideas we gathered across about the potential futures and technologies? And we started to make a documentary. At that time, the Tegenlicht, which is like, I think in the Netherlands, quite.
Like a well-known investigative journalism.
Exactly. So that form at that time, I was also doing a lot of investigation. I really loved that form of journalism. Mm. And we said, maybe we can put it in that kind of form. So essentially, we made a Tegenlicht documentary filled with all our observations about potential futures and new technologies. Personally, I also come across that, like, one, okay, we are destroying the globe and all the wildlife on it. So that was really clear for me at that time. And second, of course, we found a lot of new technologies. Among that was the Internet of Things, the upcoming of the Internet of Things, big data, that kind of topic. So essentially the whole idea of connecting every little thing on the earth. So going beyond connecting every person, but also connecting everything. And with everything, you could also imagine every wildlife. Hmm. So there, essentially, the whole idea of the Internet of Life started for me, but also the necessity of protecting wildlife. And at the telecom operator, I didn't really see a lot of opportunities to do really something with that, because essentially the telecom operator has a broader function and was more directed to, of course, making profit and serving big companies and consumers, of course. So at the same time, I was still going with my head like, okay, how can I put all this knowledge to actually do something against the wildlife destruction? And there I started to investigate this new technology called LoRaWAN, which is currently one of the biggest standards in Internet of Things technology, to actually use that technology in Tanzania at the rhino sanctuary to protect rhino. So I did that essentially on the side, And essentially at some point I said, no, I can't do this on the side. I have to do it full time because this is, yeah, this deserves all my attention. So I essentially quit KPN. And that was the start of the Internet of Life and later Smart Parks.
Right.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And so just take the listeners just a step back to something you just mentioned, which is a technology called LoRaWAN, which will not be a familiar topic to some of the listeners. So can you just explain what is LoRaWAN and why is it so advantageous over networks that we'd had previous?
Yeah, so one step back indeed is like when you envision the Internet of Things or an environment where everything is connected, literally, you need something to do that. So you're not talking about 100 things or 100 persons around a Wi-Fi spot or a telecom tower. If you consider things, then you're talking about billions and billions of devices. Therefore, you need a different technology. And that's where you see this Internet of Things coming. So you see a lot of new wired and wireless technologies that can essentially do this. If you want a lot of things that want to or need to be connected, have a lot of constraints, for example. And then you can think about the size. So not all things can carry a lot of batteries, for example, or a lot of weight. Some things are really remote, so they can't be wirelessly connected. Mm. So they need to be wireless connected. So what I'm trying to say is that if you want to connect everything, then you need new technologies to do that are low power, long range. And this is essentially where the technology LoRa came up, which is a wireless technology that can do communications over very long distances, securely, but with a very limited amount of power. Mm-hmm. Therefore, yeah, extremely suitable for Internet of Things, for a lot of device categories. Just to give you an example, one receiver, which we call a gateway, can receive up to 10,000 sensors or devices at the same time. Mm. So if you want to indeed go towards the Internet of Things, where you connect like literally everything, then you need this type of capacity to do this. And this technology can do this safely. So this is why it immediately, when it popped up, it was one of the biggest candidates worldwide to be the leading standard for a lot of connected things. And this is currently, it has evolved into that. So it was actually a good guess.
Yeah. And also I think an important catalyst for being able to do the work that you do in wildlife conservation in really remote areas, which is one of the challenges also with keeping those animals safe, is because those habitats are so large and to cover such wide expanses and are so remote. Take us into, we talked briefly about some of the threats, but take us just into the life of a wildlife ranger in Tanzania. What kind of challenges are they facing on a day-to-day basis, and how can technology like that Smart Parks uses actually help them do their jobs more effectively?
Yeah, so unfortunately, a lot of remote areas are indeed remote, but not that remote that no poachers are being active. Mm. So one of the key species where we started with, that we started protecting was the eastern black rhino, the rhino, which lives in remote areas, but is very valuable target in terms of poaching for its horns. Essentially, if you leave a black rhino roaming without any protection in terms of rangers trying to surround it or fences or keeping people off, essentially it's dead. It will be taken, it will be poached, the horn will be sold, and a lot of money will be made. So essentially what you need to do in this remote area is you need to protect those very valuable assets. But it's not an asset or a thing that is sitting still all day. No, it's moving, it's browsing, it's hiding it's hiding in bushes. So how do you protect something that is in a remote area with other dangers, other predators, and that is also needs protection, for example, at night? So how do you do that? Now, then that is what the rangers have to do, essentially. That's their mission. So they need to protect a high valuable target in a remote area, day and night, 24/7. Yeah, if it's behind a bush, if you're not trained, you can't see it. You won't notice that it's there, even like 100 meters away. So essentially, knowing where the animal is can be vital, because knowing where the animal is, you can position yourself in a good perimeter around that animal or animals, so that the likelihood of poachers entering that zone, I would say the kill zone, is minimized. And something that we call situational awareness is something that you want to have on the ground, but also on the central level, where you can coordinate these things, is very important. So having the right information, communicating with your rangers, knowing where the animals are, knowing if the fences are still up, that kind of stuff. That all that information you want to collect, and you want to start moving your security forces around it. And it's a super sad thing, of course, but it's not it's not easy to do that in remote locations, of course.
No, and it's incredibly, at least from what I read, incredibly dangerous work as well. Because you've taken us into the day of the life of a wildlife ranger, and being able to, there's a very clear case for being able to use this technology. How technologically advanced are poachers in this day and age? Are we facing a bit of a tech arms race when it comes to the wildlife protectors and the wildlife poachers?
Yes, this is happening, but I don't think that is the biggest threat. Yes, of course, some poachers are, it depends a little bit per area as well, but some poachers are more organized than the others. Some are really opportunistic, but some syndicates, because there is like organized crime behind this, especially in South Africa, for example, there is really organized attempts and can be really at a high level with really sophisticated weapons, but also with intelligence and a lot of good park management operations or rhino protection or other animal protection operations involve a lot of intelligence as well. So that goes way beyond tracking animals. But yes, of course, technology is also being used by poachers. And one of the triggers actually we had to use LoRaWAN as a technology is that when I went out in Tanzania to see how they were protecting the rhino, I actually found out that the technology may also be harmful for actually exposing the position of the animal. So I found out that they were using horn implants, meaning they put in a very small tracker, or actually it's not a tracker, it's a beacon inside the horn of a rhino, which is transmitting like a pulse. It's called VHF, so very high frequency pulse. It's a radio pulse on a specific frequency, so you can tune your antenna into it, and you would hear a ping. And the closer you get, the louder the ping, essentially. Yeah,
it's like a game of Marco Polo.
Yeah, essentially, it's the way they've been tracking rhinos for decades already, and it's. But the problem with this is that this ping, if you just scan frequencies, can be found with, I always say, $10 equipment, which is true. So, and this technology, VHF technology, has been used on all kinds of collars, also like lion collars and cheetah collars. So essentially what I found is that even tour operators in remote parks like Serengeti, they offer their customers like a wildlife guarantee. So you book a very expensive safari and you get the guarantee to see the big five. Mm-hmm. And some of these tour operators, they have like a VHF radio in the vehicle. So they turn it on in the morning and they hear like, I hear a ping of a collar. So I'm going to drive that direction to see if it's there. Of course, a rhino transmitting this signal can easily be detected also by a poacher this way.
Right.
So I said, well, I understand why you're doing this, but essentially you should use a more modern technology where there's radio signals coming off this horn, but then secured and without exposing the position of the animal. Mm-hmm. So this triggered for me essentially to develop this new LoRa tag. And that's where we started to build a new system that can do this. And currently that is being done. So a lot of rhino have these new tags in the horn where they no longer expose their position over VHF, but have an encrypted signal with their GPS position in there.
I see. And then you work together with these tour operators.
No, we actually don't work with those tour operators because we actually don't want them to have that position. It also breaks down all the fun of going on a safari. You need to use your... But that's my personal opinion, of course. But we do it... The only thing what we do essentially is we only do it for park management and wildlife protection. If it's for some other purpose, we are usually off the... Yeah, off the table. We say no. That's not something you can ask us. We are not going to support that.
So people, tour operators may come to you and ask, we would like to use your technology so that we can offer these wildlife guarantees, these sightings. We can guarantee them. But then you say, no, this is not a project for us. We are purely in the business of doing wildlife management and park management.
Yeah, but essentially that question is not directly asked to us because we all always work for park management. So also the data is not our data, which is also always an important question, these kind of things. But we provide a tool to park management to do what they do. And one of the main goals of a protective area is to protect that area and everything in it and everything surrounding it. So protect humans from, for example, elephants that are inside the park. So it's not only protect what is inside the park, but it's also what's outside the park. And that is a mission of the park or protected area. And there are, and we are supporting them with tools. And it is going way beyond only tracking rhino or lion, but it's also like, okay, are my electric fences still working? Or where are my vehicles? If this is an area where there's tourism, are there tourists stuck? So are the tourists at danger? Are tourists overspeeding? And if you know they're overspeeding, they're driving too fast, they can cause accident or they can hit animals or that kind of stuff. So all that kinds of information, we support providing that information with the smart park system so that they can do better park management. So it goes way beyond wildlife tracking.
I see. And then it's on the park to decide what kind of collaboration they want to pursue with the tour operators.
Yeah. And I can give you an example, which is way closer to home for us in terms of it's in Europe, it's in the Netherlands. There is this wildlife park close to the coast. It's called the Kennemer Dunes. It's a protected area and they have introduced a European bison.
Yeah.
Fun fact, a European bison is bigger than an American bison. So you can imagine these are huge animals being reintroduced, which is called rewilding in the Netherlands. And this area is also open to the public. Parts of the year. So you can actually go onto the path. You can just enter that area. You can cross the electric fence and you can walk there. Of course, there are rules that you cannot go within 50 meters of the bison because, well, it can be dangerous, essentially. Not to be recommended, although it happens. But essentially, the position of those animals, we also help to track. So we've developed a special collar to track these animals on high resolution, and this information is used by park management to study grazing patterns because these animals have a function also for the landscape to keep it open and to make sure that is that the nature restores. But also, the position of these animals are being communicated on a website with some delay, so that actually visitors can have a higher chance of seeing the bison. So if you go to www.wisent.nl, you actually can see where are the bison. You can actually go to a map and the information from these colors are being sent to this map. So you have a higher chance of seeing them.
What's the delay?
There's some delay and some areas are, let's say grayed out. So if the animal's there, the position will not be sent. So when they are too close to the path or something like that. But in general, it helps to give you a wildlife guarantee in a way that you would do with tour operators. So I think even those things are possible. Mm. But here it's also thought of, like, with the protection of the animals still, that people can't get too close. And even I want to get one step further, is that we actually have a new collar developed, with, again, a state of the art. We are actually monitoring with the new collars how close by people will get based on their cell phone signals. So most people that are outside, they have a smartphone in their pocket, right?
Mm-hmm.
This smartphone is exposing either Bluetooth or Wi-Fi signals because it's trying to, you know, engage with a network.
Mm-hmm.
These signals can be detected by our collar, and the signal strength can also be detected. And then the collar knows essentially, there are smartphones close by, and actually I can see how close by because of the signal strength. So we can now monitor when people get too close, or too often can get too close to the animal, so that, again, park management can potentially intervene and say, we see that this week there are so many encounters with people. This is not what we want. So we may gonna adjust the rules, or we may gonna, you know, change some of the management rules.
It's not at the point yet where you can identify who that phone belongs to and then go give them a fine or a stern talking to.
Well, this is of course possible to some extent, but this is not allowed. So essentially, there's a lot of rules about this, on privacy rules, of course. So this data is randomized and made unrecognizable. From a technology standpoint, this is, well, there are a lot of possibilities, of course, and everybody knows this. You can just scan a lot of things.
Yeah.
Luckily, a lot of smartphones nowadays have randomized MAC addresses. So they randomize and then make yourself unrecognizable by this type of scanning. But still, there are good rules. And of course, we obey them. So we don't store that data.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's fascinating that we're getting a little bit closer to home, because the Gennemer Duinen, the dunes, is, for anyone who knows the Netherlands, is an incredibly small country. So the fact that we even have a nature reserve that would be expansive enough to rewild it with European bison, which apparently are larger than American bison, which that's the first thing I'm going to Google after this recording, as I'm very curious. So, I mean, we talked about the threats of poaching in really remote areas, but can we shift our attention a little bit? I think this example does a good job in showing that, is that a lot of this technology can actually be used to help prevent and alleviate these human-wildlife conflicts that I think more and more urban areas around the world are facing with, as we have these almost conflicting agendas of urbanization and development, but at the same time, also a lot of willpower, both politically and I'd say in the culture, to do rewilding initiatives. So how do you think the technology, do you have any specific example where we're seeing a lot more of this human wildlife conflict and how this technology might be able to help?
Well, it's a global trend. A lot of people, or some people, think it's only, you know, a topic for Africa, but essentially it's a worldwide trend. So because people are taking up more space, this space is cannot be used by wildlife.
Right.
So essentially, if we take more land for agriculture or for housing, then the wildlife currently has to suffer from that, because they lose their roaming areas. And in some cases, or in most cases, this leads to conflict at the edges of this, from human area versus agriculture area versus wildlife area, and a mix of that. And personally, I realized a couple of years ago that this was happening also in Europe and also in America, essentially everywhere. So where in Africa we talk about human wildlife conflict with elephants, or for example, even I think it's even more striking in India. There's even more conflicts with, for example, elephants, but also other animals, of course, where free-roaming elephants go into villages to find food and then, of course, find villages and farmers and kids and, you know, people. And then elephants die and people die. And in, for example, in the Netherlands, we see the same, but we see it with
wolves.
With the wolf, the big discussion going on with the wolf coming back as a rewilding present, I would say, from my perspective, but from other perspectives, like a farmer seeing some of his sheep taken, that's a difference. So that's also a conflict. And then, for example, if you move to Namibia, there's also a lot of conflict where, for example, lion are taking other livestock. So people trying to make money from the livestock are being attacked almost every day by lion prides, taking all their stock,
right,
taking out their livelihood. That's another conflict. And then these people are going to attack the lion, of course. And then, you know, big mess. All over the world, this is happening. And essentially, it's getting worse. And then comes the question, what do you do about it? And I think technology, again, is just one of the tools we have to help find new ways of managing. And in some cases, I think we have to give nature more space. That's how I think about it. But still, then even if we give more space back to nature, there will be these areas where you have this interaction.
So there's always going to be a border.
Exactly. And I think we at least have to use technology to manage those borders more effectively and efficient. If you essentially know where the animals are and you know when an elephant is crossing a border, even if you have put up a fence, because again, a fence is also technology. Don't forget, a fence may not even be a smart fence, but it is technology. If an elephant is crossing a fence into a village, I think it would be really nice to know before it happens. So sure. Essentially, you can alarm the villages like, okay, maybe it's not wise to go outside in 10 minutes. Like, mm-hmm. We use technology to see like, it's bad weather coming. Actually, I can see literally, you know, with Buinradar, I can see whenever it's going to rain in like 5 minutes.
Hey, it's me, Nadina. Just popping in here to encourage you to take me outside. Listen to the podcast as you stroll through your local park, take a bike ride along the river, or ski down a mountain, whatever suits you. I know it's what the sponsor of today's episode would want. This podcast is brought to you by the Nature Conservancy's Global Coalition, Nature for Climate. The discussion around climate change can be overwhelming and honestly downright daunting. The Nature for Climate Coalition focuses on what we can do rather than what's been lost. Its partners, including the Nature Conservancy, work together to get natural climate solutions such as avoiding deforestation in the tropics and restoring wetlands and sustainably managing forests implemented across the public and private sectors. Restoring nature is one of our best chances for mitigating climate change and also creating happy, healthy, and green communities for future generations. And that's exactly what we like to hear here at the Internet of Nature podcast. Find out how at natureforclimate.org. Okay, now get yourself outside and back to the show. Yeah, just for the non-Dutch Buinradar is a kind of rain alert system that any Dutch person or anyone living in the Netherlands is very, very familiar with before you hop on your bike to go to your next meeting.
Exactly. But what if you want to hop on your bike to go to your farm or to your land where to get crop for your next meal?
Yeah.
Maybe there's an app or an alarm that says, there's two elephants walking your way. Maybe it's wise to wait another 10 minutes, then it's free.
Yeah.
You know, so I am using all day technology to make my life more convenient. But I think we, in a lot of places, and also, again, here in the Netherlands, I would like to see more technology to being used to protect wildlife. And then also making my life more convenient because, you know,
sure.
It's also important.
Sure. Yeah, and protecting people too, because it sounds like that's a real danger here in a lot of these conflicts, is it is truly a conflict in the sense that, I mean, if you look at these elephant conflicts, who dies? Is it the person or the elephant? And that's kind of what it boils down to. And if there's a way to protect both, then that's, I think, that we should be aiming for.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is possible. Of course, you cannot prevent everything with technology, but there will always be like these areas where you have to manage this interaction in a way, and then technology can help.
Right. And I read also that cities can be interesting kind of experimental labs for smart parks in a way. I read about a project that you guys did in New York City called COVID Cats. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
It's quite interesting. We got approached by Columbia University by a researcher called Laura Dudley Plimpton. And she is studying disease transmissions in urban environments amongst urban cats, so city cats, which are feral, but sometimes also domestic, of course. But also animals like raccoons, like living in parks.
Right. And or in garbage cans.
In garbage cans, they live in colonies. And, well, I don't know if you should call them wildlife. I don't know. It's a label, but it's life. It's living in the city.
It's wild. I'd say and it's wildlife.
It's certainly wild. So
you do not want to come across one of those raccoons. From living in Toronto, I can tell you.
Yeah, and there are a lot.
We need an alert system for the raccoons.
So it's pretty wild. Right? So these cities become wild places in that sense. So actually here they wanted to study like disease transmission also with COVID to see like is there like disease transmission between house cats, which of course also have contact with humans.
Sure.
Also with COVID transmission possibilities and then with these populations, these colonies. And how is that happening? So what is that dynamic? And they ask us, like, is your system capable of doing that? And at that point, we were actually working on those Wisent collars or the European Wisent collars where we can actually see smartphones. But essentially, this is the same thing as what the COVID app is doing in a lot of countries. Like these phones can see each other and then they report like, you have been near this person's phone, therefore this person has COVID, therefore you are also at risk. Essentially, the trackers we built can do the same, but then they are scanning for each other, essentially. So if two cats have a collar on, which is transmitting Bluetooth beaconing information, the other collar can scan for it and then can say, I've seen you at that time and you have been this close. Okay. Right. And I'm going to report that to the network. So essentially we start, we can try to do that, but our collars are way too big to be put on cats. So essentially we had
bison collars on cats. I'm seeing it already.
That's probably not a good plan. So we first had to completely redesign our tracker. So yeah, we went into a couple of iterations and we managed to put out about 16 collars, or actually Laura did. We did everything remotely, which is also really cool. We actually asked the local LoRaWAN community to assist the project with building a network around the cemetery where we did the research.
Very cool.
And at some point we started following these cats, and currently the first results are being written down in papers, so hopefully being published. But yeah, very very interesting use of technology on cats and raccoons and living in cities. So yeah.
So in that sense, the city, the urban area can be a little bit of an easier, at least more accessible lab for a lot of these different technologies.
Nah, I don't think it's easier. Essentially going
harder.
Into, well, it's different. And technology usually is very good at doing one thing and very bad in doing another thing. So yes, some technologies are really flexible, but for example, getting GPS positions using satellites, always need to have clear skies. And in cities with high buildings and with a lot of obstructions, cats going underneath cars and there's a lot of metal, it's really hard to get good GPS positions. So therefore, sometimes if you even use your smartphone, well, today it can be done better, but in the past when you had a smartphone with GPS and you were going into a city, your signal was really bad. So because the satellites are, you know, behind buildings. This is essentially what also happens with these type of collars. In the bush, you don't have this problem, of course. There's no metal roofs. There's no, you know, no buildings. So here we are actually still have to adjust some of our technologies to work with, let's say, urban tracking technology. So exactly, for example, using Wi-Fi hotspots to locate where the tracker is, which is what your phone always is doing as well. And that doesn't work in the bush because there are no Wi-Fi spots in the bush.
Nor should there be, probably.
No, so so it's different. Therefore, we had different problems. And we're still adapting our technology to to be in that sense more flexible to also being used in cities. But to be honest, most use cases we support are not in cities. This is essentially the only use case in an urban environment.
Yeah, no, I bet. But what about, so, you know, we talked about these different, you know, human nature conflicts that can happen, human wildlife conflicts that can happen at the borders of urban areas. Would you see, how do you see that kind of play into the overall strategy of smart parks? Is that something you want to pursue further?
Yeah, I think that's at the core. That's what we are doing already. So again, we in that sense just a tool. So we follow protected management practices. So what you see is that there's more and more attention for these areas where the conflict is high. And then we get approached and they say like, okay, can you help us to manage this border more effectively with your technology? And then we say, okay, this is what we already can do. And this is something we may have to do some development for. So then we start another, what we call research and development cycle. Mm-hmm. And we add new capabilities. Maybe a strange example, we are working, since last year, we were working in a very remote area in Mozambique called Niassa. And Niassa is a province in the north of Mozambique, and it's to the west of Cabo Delgado province, where there is a huge conflict going on, like a small war going on. And actually insurgents from that area are being pushed out of that province into this nature reserve.
I see.
And these insurgents create all kinds of wildlife destruction because these people have to live from something. So you get a lot of substance hunting, you get a lot of illegal mining, they carry weapons, heavy weapons, so you get a lot of security issues. So essentially where this area is already super remote and, you know, very hard to manage with limited resources, they got another problem having insurgents coming into this area more and more. So essentially they, for example, asked us, can you help us to more effectively monitor this huge, you know, border to this mm-hmm. province to better recognize when insurgents are entering the area so we can try to intervene, or at least we know. So we are now trying to adjust our what we call Ranger Edge tracker, which is like a ranger tracker or a device that can be used for rangers to expose their position to the control center, but also to communicate. To use that tracker essentially as a sensor which can be placed on remote locations, so not on a ranger, but for example on a tree. Mm-hmm. And then it should be able to detect insurgents based on a couple of strategies. One is sound, so acoustics. They told us that, for example, insurgents can come on motorbikes. If you can detect the sound of a motorbike, then you almost certainly know that there's an insurgent entering your area. So if this sensor can detect motorbike acoustics, which can be done by training the computer chip to recognize this. So we have a microphone on board, and this computer chip then can be trained with machine learning, which is another upcoming technology, which is called TinyML, meaning machine learning, artificial intelligence, but then deployed on the actual chip. So not running in the cloud, so it's running on the chip. It can ingest acoustic data, so sound information, and then it can be trained to recognize, for example, very specific sounds. And that's the next thing we want to try, is that we want to use computer vision, so a camera, to, for example, recognize groups of people and maybe even arms. So, for example, we put a small camera, again, with a trained machine learning model on it, to detect persons, count them, and maybe even, and that's something I hope we can also do, is to detect if a person is carrying a weapon. Then that sensor will not be able to send those images over, because again, it's very remote areas. There's no 4G, there's no 5G, there's no power. So it has to run for a long time, really silently, really covert. So we're using the LoRa technology again, LoRaWAN. So the device essentially needs to be super, super smart. Therefore, we use TinyML. Mm. So if we can then detect this and only send the outcome of it to the central location, the park has more situation awareness. It gets a notification in a map saying, ah, we have detected suspicious activity and we have an 80% chance of having a motorbike detected. Gotcha. And then the park management, for example, can say, ah, we have like 25 kilometers away or 10 kilometers away, we have an anti-poaching team, we send it in. Or
dispatch.
If it's a really bad situation, like a lot of triggers, you may even send in the chopper or something. So, this is an actual question we got. And yeah, we are now trying to evolve our Ranger Edge tracker to actually do this kind of things.
Wow. This just, I mean, it seems like so many different technologies, so many different use cases. Where have you seen the most success over the last several years?
To be honest, I have, in all the parks where we have been active, there has not been any rhino poaching. So...
Wow.
That is at the core of what we do.
That's incredible.
And yeah, I, of course, it's not only because what we have been doing there and what we've been adding, but at least we helped to prevent.
Do you think that success is due to the fact that because of more situational awareness, as you were saying, the ranger teams are better able to dispatch and step in and intervene where necessary? Do you think that that situational awareness, that information, is at the heart of that success?
It certainly helps. I don't think you can really prove that one single piece of technology or one single approach has led to this, because essentially all those protected areas do things slightly different. But what they share is definitely information, a very good information position. So this also, again, involves like intelligence, which is going different routes. But definitely it's information position and putting your resources at the right locations and preventing things from happening. That is definitely the case.
I mean, it seems like it allows you to have much more of a data-driven strategy.
I think it's in even if you don't use technology like this, it's always about your information position. So if you want to protect a huge area, even if you don't have any radios or whatever, you also have to rely on some information. Like on a daily basis, you have to decide, where am I going to patrol?
Yeah,
I have two teams with two times five persons. I don't know. Where do I send them? Do I send them north? Or do I send them south? So first you have to know, like, okay, what's happening? Of course, a lot of these park management operations are really, you know, experienced, and they're again also in different stages. Of some people just start with the park management for 1 year, another one already protecting an area for 25 years.
Sure.
It's a bit different, of course. But it all relies on a very good information position and then making it almost real time. So what we are trying to do is that, of course, we also support a lot of research projects with our collars and trackers, but we really are focused on anti-poaching. Therefore, we try to get real time information. And this is where the technology is different than, let's say 10 years ago, where, for example, the only way to get signals out of such a remote locations was using satellite.
Right.
And satellite collars, the viewers can maybe see that there's a big satellite collar behind me. And if you're listening, it's like the mechanics of that, the electronics, is like as big as your head, essentially. But then strapped on a collar and on the back of an elephant. And that was needed to get enough batteries going on to send satellite information out.
Right.
And that requires so much power that you may only get, a GPS or position update every 3 hours or 2 hours. And then it only lasts for 2 years. So after 2 years, you again have to catch the elephant and have to put it another unit on again. So just to compare with the technology we are deploying, this payload, so this electronic unit on the collar, has shrunk to, let's say, two fists of a size. And then it sends out signals at a higher resolution, for example, every 15 minutes, a location, and then it can last for about 8 years.
8 years, no battery replacements.
So for 8 years, for example, you don't have to catch that animal again to get live locations if needed. Huh? Of course,
that's huge.
The goal is not to tag every animal. That's absolutely not the goal. But if you have to tag some of the, you know, problem animals that go in and out the park all the time, you don't want to catch it every 2 years to replace his heavy load, huge satellite collar. No, you want to do it, you know, maybe once in 5 years or 8 years.
Sure.
And you want to have a higher resolution of information, because 1 hour it may be still in the park and the next hour it's already out.
Yeah.
So essentially that's what we also did in terms of innovativeness. It's like, a complete different performance level.
Right. Yeah, because I've done quite some work using IoT sensors for tree health, which of course is a similar technology, but a completely different assets. Because obviously, if you mess up or you lose connectivity or it's broken or whatever it is, whatever challenges you run into, you just go back to that tree and you fix it. Obviously, that's not the case with an elephant. I can't even imagine the team it must take to be able to tranquilize, I assume, an elephant so that you can replace these collars or fix them.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Actually, we are just back from an operation in Zimbabwe where we deployed a complete smart parks network in Gunnera Zoo National Park. It's the home of the biggest elephant populations on Earth. And for the first time ever in my career as well, I was actually with a collaring operation with one of our own collars. With the new Elephant Edge collar, which was the first Elephant Edge collar that was deployed in the field. And actually, I got to do it myself. And I was really surprised with that opportunity. And but of course, I know all the stories and I've seen, you know, all the things around what to do and how to do an elephant collaring. But I've never been with it. And actually, the effort it takes and the discipline and the team that was involved and a helicopter, an airplane and two vehicles and all the tools. People sometimes don't realize like what you have to do to actually get that animal on the ground and also do it safely. Because if you do it and you're unlucky, even you can't prevent everything. But if the animal falls down on its wrong side or with his trunk or a stick on its head or something, then you even lose the animal. So I was really impressed by this and also humble. And also it motivated me and my team even more to make sure that whatever we put on that animal is doing as much as we can. It must be the smartest and the best thing we put on. You know, everybody is looking at his smartphone all day with an amazing amount of technology in there, but that, you know, people are spending so much money on that stuff. But if only we put that effort in making better wildlife trackers, it's not comparable. So it made me really humble, but also it reinforced our mission. Like, we need to make these things better, smaller, last longer, more smart. Yeah, it was an amazing experience, and we hopefully in the next week or two we will expose a video about this operation. We put everything on camera so people actually can try to be a bit part of this journey, because it's pretty special.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. We'll put that in the show notes so people can check it out once it's out. That's incredible, Tim. That actually kind of leads me to my next question, which is, what is the future of this? You already mentioned a little bit that the goal is not to track every single animal. And I can completely relate to that, because my goal is also not to track every single tree. So I can completely understand where I think that idea and that philosophy comes from. But if that's not the goal, what is?
The goal is to be as non-invasive as possible, meaning if we can use technology where we don't have to, you know, touch the animal, then it's even better. So that's why, for example, computer vision is so important, and things like drones. And actually, that is the background also of one of our other co-founders, Laurence de Groot, who has started also an initiative before Smart Parks called ShadowView. But that is, you know, that's something, some technology that is non-invasive in that sense.
Can I interrupt you there?
Because sure.
That was another question that I had, because I've read a lot about, I think it was a Microsoft AI for Earth program that also based on, because we're at the point now with satellite imagery that we have the resolution and the frequency that if you can and if you have the money to spend on the imagery, you can get high resolution, as in under a meter resolution of the same areas every single day. And I know that there's really, really intelligent people that are working on computer vision algorithms to, for example, identify elephants and their location from space. How do you see that technology? Are you a fan of it? Do you think it works? And a second part of that question is, could there be a way to fuse the two for optimal effort?
I think there has been amazing advancements with satellite imagery, and I think I've been also using them, but I think we have to realize that there cannot be enough satellites in the sky to monitor all the animals. And also, you know, then we get to a really, really important question. The technology we use, we have to always make a decision what we use it for. Do we use it to protect elephant, or are we using it to make more profit for doing something industrial? And if we want to protect, you know, all the wildlife in specific areas with, you know, satellites are not cheap. No. Satellites are extremely expensive. And yes, they have become way cheaper because of our big friend Elon Musk, of course. But still, if you want to monitor this with satellite, I don't think it's feasible. That's one. Two, there's also a big problem with this, because if you put the sky full of that many satellites, you cannot even see a single star anymore, which I think is also part of nature, to be able to look outside.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's interesting technology. And yes, I think it should be used, and it's already being used. It's actually adding to situational awareness, for example, to detect fires. So forest fire detection is part of the situational awareness tool where we also feed in our real-time data. It's called Earth Ranger. And inside Earth Ranger, there's this application that also detects like forest fires and fires on savannas, so that you can actually also use that for park management, because poachers also use fire to push animals into certain direction and then poach them make them push them into snares. So, definitely that's important. Also, satellites are also being used, and also we use it to build better communication networks. I think that is a better application of satellites in this case, that has bigger implications than satellites to observe all the animals. So, for example, colors of elephants. Elephants also go out of protected areas through corridors and may even cross country borders. If you want to keep on monitoring them, then, yeah, of course, you want to have a connection with them. The LoRaWAN network we are building is usually terrestrial, so it's with towers. But the cool thing with LoRaWAN, it's also good enough to communicate with space. So there are currently already some LoRaWAN-capable satellites, among them Lacuna Space, which can actually receive those LoRaWAN signals from the same elephant collars. Meaning, if they go out of a terrestrial network, their signals can still be picked up by very low power satellites. So in this case, I think space and satellites, IoT satellites, are playing a really, really important job.
Where they can complement each other.
Yeah, and the third one is, of course, Starlink-like networks, where a lot of locations where we are, for example, in Yasa, there is no 4G, you know?
No.
Some places, of course, but in a lot of places, there's nothing like a telecom network where you have high-speed internet connectivity. And traditional satellite connections are very slow and very expensive. And now you have this, you know, Starlink network for 100 euros a month. You have
a month,
like,
yeah.
So that's also what we are. Yeah, we actually have a Starlink here at the office in Utrecht, which is useless. But we're using it to test, like, once it gets available in Africa, how would that change the game and how stable is it? So we are already preparing ourselves also to export that to Africa, of course.
Right. So that's part of the future vision, is being able to use these less invasive technologies to ultimately be able to monitor and track and protect more animals with ultimately less invasive technology?
Yeah, so, but I think that should be a vision in the end to if you don't need to track an animal, or if you don't need to catch an animal to protect it, then it's obviously better.
You almost want to render yourselves obsolete in a way?
Always. I try to do that literally every day. No, that's the core of what we are trying to do. We also not try to make like a business model or something, or operational model where people are stuck to us. So also everything we do, we make open source as much as possible, so that if tomorrow I get, hit by lightning, then everything is online and somebody else with the same passion and some knowledge can take it up and can continue. I don't want to make things, if we can make ourselves obsolete, then that would be the best case ever.
Wow.
Then we can go out and watch nature instead of, putting cars
with no guarantees, of course, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah, no, but of course, if you go out, and that's what we do a couple of times a year, we go out in the bush and we get to experience this and we get to work with them. But of course, always at the end of the day, you realize like, geez, what kind of stupid things we have to do to keep these animals safe. And then you get over the radio, you get the incident of, poaching incident, people get shot. And then you're like, what? It's that's sad, of course.
You mentioned that. So one of the things that really, makes you happy at the end of the day is feeling like, you are rendering the technology in a way, and smart parks perhaps even as obsolete. How do you, when you encounter obviously tragedies like that, how do you stay positive and how do you stay optimistic throughout your work?
With these encounters. So you have to, of course, I'm sitting in the office most of the time working on technology with multimeters and analyzers and computers and stuff, which is fun. That's part of the passion. You have to have passion for this to keep on doing it. But if you want to refuel this, the reason why you're doing it, you have to actually go out and see nature. So if you are touching the skin or even be close to an elephant or a lion, if you have this encounter, and the people that have encountered it know this, that you just have to have one of or two of those experiences and you're sold. Look a rhino in the eye and you're sold. And for everybody, it's different animal, of course. But for me, it's like elephant, rhino, even lying, if you look them in the eye and you have this connection and you're like, okay, yeah, that's enough. Then we're going to do everything we can to make sure that they are not suffering for these stupid choices we are making as mankind. So I think that is what fuels you. So that's what we try to do, go out at least a couple of times a year to Africa, but also here in Europe or in the UK
to refuel the passion.
Yeah, to actually connect with nature in a non-technology way. So the stupid thing is that I'm able to watch all these connected animals through my secure connection with these parks. So with three clicks, I can actually see the location of a rhino in a very remote area. And I know I can, because I've been there, I can envision how that would look. So I always literally see that animal. Of course, I can't see it, but I see it. I know the sensor. I know, every little thing that's inside there. So I feel strongly connected then to that animal. So although it's a connection going through all kinds of switches and routers and even through the air, through satellites, it's arriving, or it's, that signal is actually coming from the tip of a horn.
Yeah.
Realizing that you are literally connected. Of course, you are always connected through the same air and everything we breathe, but there is more like a technology connection. And then there's this emotional connection on top of it. The same maybe as you are maybe away from your family or friend or your partner or your kid, and you are doing a phone call. It doesn't even have to be, or it can even be an SMS message. Like, one message like, hey, how are you? I'm fine. That, it's stupid because they're just words coming through, some stupid technology. But the thing is, it's more than just a couple of words coming through this technology. It's your connection with that person or thing on the other side of that line. And this works the same with Rhino carrying a GPS sensor. So knowing that that GPS sensor is still working, knowing that the accelerometer is showing signs of living, so you see it's moving and it's not dead on the ground, just by seeing it, you feel more comfortable, which is, of course, a bit stupid, but this is how it works.
Right. And yeah. Who knows? Maybe one day the Rhino will be able to text back.
Well, I think they're already talking to us, but yeah, indeed. Maybe with sound or something, which is actually not a stupid idea.
No, but, that's a discussion for another time, but there's some incredible technology being used to actually interpret animal language and sounds, and that's a whole other conversation, but who knows in the future.
Well, we're doing it with Elephant Edge, so if you want to see more about that stuff, you have to look up the Elephant Edge campaign, where we actually try to ask people in the public through open source initiative to actually use acoustic from elephants to be able to detect what they are trying to say to us. And then, yeah, the elephant caller should be able to listen through those sounds again and say, ah, this elephant is not feeling happy.
Amazing.
Yeah, crazy.
Tim, I could keep asking you questions. This has been fascinating. I think we could go for another couple hours, but this is not the Joe Rogan show, so I won't do that to you. Where can people find more online about you, about Smart Parks, and about Elephant Edge and the Open Collar Initiative, which we didn't even get to?
Yeah, of course, really easy. Just go to www.smartparks.org. And there's quite some information. We try to keep it actual, as much as possible. And yeah, if you want to support, or there's of course also a donate button, because we only rely on funding from outside. So yeah, that's the place to go.
Amazing. And the last question that I ask all of my guests who come on the show is, what does the Internet of Nature mean to you?
For me, it's about internet. It's about making connections, transferring information. And in this case, we are also part of nature, and the wildlife is also part of nature. So I think this is what it's all about, to be able to connect to each other with the purpose of creating a better life for everybody. So creating a better life, and this is true connection. So that is what it means to me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Tim, for coming on. This has been truly fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Internet of Nature podcast. Want to learn more about the Internet of Nature? Subscribe to my biweekly newsletter at nadinachala.com. I'm looking forward to bringing you another great guest next week. As always, remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review if you learned something new. The best way to support us is to share this episode with a friend or a colleague. Wishing you a great week. This show is an Unbound Media production.